screens come down, I'll say thank you all for coming. It's a pleasure to be on our future experience. My name is Corbett, I write for LWN and other things. Today, I'm going to be talking about the state of the Linux kernel projects, how we got to where we are now, and where we are going from here. I will be covering an awful lot of material fairly quickly. So I would like to invite you, if there are questions at any time during the talk, raise your hand and ask, and hopefully we'll have some time at the end of the talk as well for questions. It is always more fun if I get questions than when I know people are actually listening. Do we have to do something? Okay, well, I will continue without the slides until they show up. The theme that I'm starting with here, there we go, is a quote from Andrew Wharton, senior kernel developer. He said this back in 2005, that he thought the actual volume of changes going into the Linux kernel actually had to drop one of these days, because at some point you were actually going to finish the kernel project. Now, he said this just as the 2.6.14 kernel was coming together and getting ready for release. So I went back to see if we had actually finished it and if the patch volume dropped off or not. Of course, I knew the answer, but this is what it looks like. Way, way over on the left-hand side is the number of changes which went into 2.6.14, which was just under 4,000 individual changes. Since then, the patch volume has most certainly not dropped off. You're seeing the number of changes that went into each kernel release up to 2.6.29, which is the last one that I have on my slide here. If I had 2.6.30, it would actually be just a little bit more. The kernel grew by a full 2.1 million lines of code and so on. If you break that down, in other words, what this says that for every day of the last year, or the last 11 months, we have put 131 changes into the kernel and added 6,500 lines of code. Every single day, without a break for weekends or holidays or anything like that. So the kernel is, in fact, a very active development project. It is going to be one of the most widespread and active projects of any software project in the world, be it free software or proprietary software or what have you. There are very few projects that match this kind of rate of change and rate of development. So we looked a bit at where these changes came from, and this is always an interesting slide to put up. Over the last year, just looking at the employers self-monitoring this work, you see that just under 20% of the changes that went into the kernel during this time came from people who were known to be working on their own time. People who were just doing something because they wanted to do it and not because it was their job to do so. Just about everything else came from people who were, in fact, being paid to do their work, who were doing it as part of their job. So if you look at the companies that are contributing at the upper end, there aren't too many surprises there. We see companies in the Linux distribution business, companies in the support business, companies that are working to support hardware that they are selling, and so on. And so over time, these numbers shift around a little bit, but it doesn't actually change all that much. This is really the picture of where the top contributors, where the top contributions are coming from. But as I said, the full list is about 300 companies long. So there are a lot of contributors that I have not been able to list on one short slide here. There's changes that are coming from all over the place. So one might ask, what are all of these developers doing here? So I'll just look at what has happened in the releases, the kernel releases, over the course of the past year, starting with 2.6.25, which came out in April of 2008. Now, any individual kernel release has, I don't know, somewhere between 50 and 100 individual device drivers in it. So I certainly couldn't list all of those. But I listed two for 2.6.25 because they were very significant contributions. The F5K driver was a driver that supported Ethereos chipsets for wireless networking, and the R500 support is for ATI, AMD, R500 graphics chipsets. Both of these represent very widely used hardware, which until this point lacked support in the mainline Linux kernel. They both represent the efforts of companies that have changed their approach towards contribution to the kernel from an attitude that was frankly hostile to that, towards one where they've decided they're going to cooperate with our process and have their hardware supported in the mainline kernel. It was a very big change for both of these, a very significant watershed event, something that we were very glad to see happen. It's a process that continues as we slowly work at beating down barriers at companies that don't want to cooperate and really get this code into the mainline kernel, which is where it needs to be. There are improvements to the EXT4 file system. I'll come back to that. This file system was essentially feature complete. This time, we saw the addition of the first new security module since SE Linux went in some years ago. SMAC is a simplified mandatory access control module for people who want to have that kind of access control without the full complexity of SE Linux. We saw group scheduling come in from the real-time tree. Real-time is another topic I will come back to later on. And we saw the addition of the memory usage controller, which is a containers feature, allowing a system administrator to put limits on the memory usage by any specific group of processes. And there's a whole lot of other stuff, of course, I cannot possibly list it all, but these were some of the significant features there. 2.6.26 came out last July, included read-only bind mounts. This is a file system feature. Again, to support containers and such, it allows a piece of the file system to be made available within a container in a read-only mode, so even privileged users within that container cannot make changes to the file system. Network namespace work is, again, container-oriented stuff. We saw, finally, support for the page attribute table feature of the x86 architecture. It took us years to get to the point where we could use this feature to precisely control the cacheability, the cache data submemory, and so on. It's an important thing. But the feature that many people will really remember from 2.6.26 was the addition of the KGDB kernel debugger for the x86 architecture. This is something that Linus Torvalds had said would never, ever, as long as he was alive, be allowed to go into the mainline kernel. But in fact, they managed to get it past him anyway. It shows that nothing is truly impossible if there is sufficient determination and sufficient willingness to address the technical issues involved. 2.6.27 came out in October. This saw the addition of the ftrace tracing framework, something I'll come back to. It was really the beginning of a much more serious focus on tracing features for the Linux kernel. Happened about then. UBIFS is a file system for solid-state storage devices. Multi-queue networking was a core change to the Linux networking stack, which actually served two very different needs. The ability to have multiple queues was necessary to support wireless networking in its full functionality, because wireless networking provides several different levels of quality of service, and so you need different queues to support that properly, and what was being done in the network stack before then was not exactly graceful. But you also need multiple network queues if you're trying to support very high-end, high-bandwidth controllers on large systems, where you want to be able to spread the load of handling a high-bandwidth network stream across multiple processors. The only way to do that in a way that scales well is with multiple packet queues, and so that feature was added to support that need as well. The GSPCA video driver set provided Linux with support for just about every webcam device that was available on the market. This is another area that was poorly served before. It was also a very interesting example of what can happen when you bring code into the kernel, because these drivers had existed for years outside of the mainline kernel as a separate GPL licensed development project. They were brought in after some of the technical problems with these drivers were fixed. But as soon as GSPCA got into the kernel, a much wider group of developers started to work on these drivers and to improve them. And they got better much more quickly than they had outside of the mainline kernel. This is a lesson that we have learned many times over. The code which is off somewhere else is code which does not receive the same level of attention as code that is in the mainline kernel itself. So there are a lot of benefits to bringing that code into the core so that it can be addressed by the full development community. Finally, we saw support for block layer integrity checking in this kernel. This is simply support for hardware which can ensure that data written to storage devices has not been corrupted in the path that it took to get there. There's a data integrity feature, which is an important step towards improving our faith in our block subsystems and so on. 2.6.28 came out just before the end of the year. One of the most significant features in this kernel was the graphics execution feature, or GEMP. This was the beginning of the end of a multi-year development process to give the Linux kernel and Linux as a whole really top quality support for 3D graphics adapters, for really good graphics at the display level. It took a long time to get this code to the point where it could go in. The first chunk of it, the GEMP code, went in for 2.6.28. It was a watershed event, getting us to where we need to be there. The ext4 file system lost its experimental designation. That was the point where the developers said that they thought it was stable and ready for wider use. It is, in fact, still stabilizing if you look at it, but it's getting closer. We'll talk more about ext4 shortly. We saw the addition of the staging tree. I just mentioned a moment ago about how drivers improve much more quickly when they go into the mainline kernel. The staging tree, which is administered by Greg, is a way to add drivers to the kernel, even if the quality of those drivers is not up to the level of that we normally would expect for Linux kernel code. And so a place to allow them to improve and to get better quickly. A lot of those 2 million lines of code which have gone into the kernel over the last year have gone in by way of the staging tree. There's a whole lot of stuff that's there. We got support for wireless USB devices. We got the container freezer. This is a facility to put a whole group of processes to sleep. It's a sort of a prerequisite to checkpoint restart and other features like that. And we saw the beginning of an effort to add static trace points to the kernel. This again is a tracing feature so that administrators can look at the state of the kernel and see what's going on production systems. 2.6.29, last March, included kernel mode setting, which is the other half of the 3D graphics equation. This moves much of the control of video chipsets into the kernel itself and out of user space programs like the x.org server, giving the kernel much more control, simplifying a lot of the user space code and generally making the system much more robust and much more ready to go forward in the future with the things we want to do with it. We saw a couple of new file systems that went into 2.6.29, which I'll come back to, LetterFS and SquashFS, which is a compressed read-only file system used on embedded devices and live CDs and places like that. Got support in the networking stack for the WiMAX broadband protocol. And a whole bunch of changes meant to support systems with 4,000 or more processors on them. Very large scalability type code. A lot of that went in for 2.6.29. Then the kernel that I thought would be the current kernel at the moment, 2.6.30, last I checked this morning, it had not actually been released yet. It might be by now. It's going to come out any moment. It's really ready to go, and I'm not quite sure what Linus is waiting for. There's a lot of stuff in the 2.6.30 kernel, including another security module called Tomoyo Linux. There is the integrity measurement code, which is a bunch of code that stayed out of tree for some years, allowing a system to use the trusted platform module within chip found in a lot of systems to ensure that the files on a system have not been tampered with and to actually attest to the system's integrity to the world as a whole. This is a feature which can be used to lock down systems, which is not necessarily something that we consider to be a good thing. Depends on what you're wanting to do. But there are certainly situations where you want to be able to do that with the Linux system. And we have better support for that now. Some changes to ext4, which I'll come back to. More graphics support for more contemporary ATI graphics chipsets. We're getting close to having good quality support for those, although this is still just two-dimensional support with those chipsets. Some real-time features like the adaptive spinning mutexes. We got support for object storage devices. This is a new class of disk storage devices where instead of managing individual sectors of data, individual blocks, these devices can actually manage whole files on their own. So if you have that kind of hardware or something that looks like that kind of hardware, you can now make use of it within the block layer within Linux. FS cache is a local caching layer for network file systems for something like NFSV4, where you want to be able to cache files locally. The NILFS log structured file system went in with 2.6.30. saw a couple of new system calls, just sort of filling out our read and write basic POSIX IO system call features, and threaded interrupt handles, which is a real-time tree feature that I'll come back to. And this is where we stand now with the current kernel. If it isn't the current kernel at the moment, it should be by tomorrow or so. I'm not quite sure. But this is where we are. So with all of this stuff which has been done, one could ask, so now, are we about finished? Is it going to drop off now? And I think the answer, I don't think anybody, not even Andrew at this point, would say that that he believes that to be true. It looks like we're going to continue to work on the kernel for a long time yet. So one might then ask, well then, what is next? What are we going to do? So that is what I will spend the rest of my talk speaking on, are just some areas where I see a lot of work being done, and trying to look forward to some of the interesting things that we will be seeing going into the kernel in the near future. Start with the networking stack. Ben Jacobson is the guy who made the internet actually work many years ago once it started to grow. And so I grabbed this quote that he came up with a couple of years ago, maybe 3 years ago now. He says that based on the measurements he's aware of, Linux has the fastest and most complete network stack of any operating system out there. Networking in Linux is generally held to be in fairly good condition, but that doesn't mean that you can't improve it. One of the developments that caught my attention recently that I think is most interesting has to do with packet filtering and firewalling. The firewalling code within Linux has been there, you know, in some form since the 2.4 kernel, the current code. It has served us well. It's very heavily used in a lot of different situations. But it has developed some problems over this time, including a bunch of duplicated code. There isn't actually one firewalling system within the Linux kernel. There's actually four of them. There's one for IPv4, one for IPv6, one for ARP, and one other one that I always forget. The way the code was built, whenever you want to add a new low-level protocol, you really have to just copy a whole lot of stuff and redo it. And so this has been done a few times. So we have a lot of duplicated code. We have a lot of things that are inconsistent between the different protocol stacks. We have bugs that get fixed in one implementation that then don't get fixed in the others. All of the problems that come with this sort of situation. The user space interface is not as good as it could be. In particular, it's very hard to replace a whole set of rules in a single operation. You can only replace them one at a time. And it lacks flexibility to do some of the things that people want to do. So the solution, which was posted really just a couple months or so ago, is a whole new packet filtering mechanism called NFTables. It takes all the protocol awareness out of the kernel and replaces it with a much dumber virtual machine. So in the current firewalling code, you might say, is this IP protocol whatever, is it going to port whatever, and so on. And the packet filtering code understands these concepts. With NFTables instead, you would load a much simpler set of code that simply says, is this number found in this piece of the packet? Does that number exist over there? So it's a much lower level thing. You would then write your firewalling rules in a higher level language, which is translated, compiled essentially, in user space. So you can at this point have any sort of language you would want to use to express your packet filtering rules in user space. These are translated by this code. They can in fact be optimized at that point in a way that cannot be done now with the current firewalling code, and then loaded into the kernel in a much simpler form. There are a lot of advantages to this, a much smaller code base for our packet filtering code, greater flexibility, and it seems even better performance from doing things this way. So it's a really worthwhile change. The interesting thing here, of course, is that there are many thousands, if not millions, of systems out there with firewall rules written for the current system. If we're going to rip all of that out and put in something totally different, this has the potential to introduce a fair amount of disruption to all of these sites, which is something that we really just do not want to do as kernel developers. So there's going to have to be a lot of thought put into how this transition can be done without breaking sites all across the network. And it's going to be very interesting to see how that plays out. I think this problem can be solved, but it's going to have to, it will take some work to make this transition happen in a way that is suitable for our users. Elsewhere in the networking code, we're seeing a lot of work with network namespaces. This is part of the container effort, trying to give different groups of processes a different view of what the networking environment is, which devices are available, essentially even what network they're connected to, and so on. That has been a huge job. It has taken a very long time to stabilize all this, and it's still being done. We're seeing improvements to the existing packet filtering code. 2.6.30 saw the addition of the reliable datagram socket protocol. This is a protocol that came out of Oracle for handling very high performance local area storage and related sorts of problems in the networking stack. And something that we're seeing being pulled together that could maybe go in for 2.6.31, I'm not sure yet, is the 802.15.4 protocol stack. This is the personal area networking stack, which supports protocols like Zigbee and related things where you have devices that are very, very close to the systems that they operate with. It's sort of, you know, something similar to Bluetooth, but a more developed protocol stack intended for this kind of device. And we'll see that coming in some point before too long, I would think. And that's what I had to say on networking. Move on to another area of very heavy development currently in the Linux kernel, and that is the area of file systems. There's a whole range of problems that need to be solved, starting with the problem of replacing file systems like ext3 and ReiserFS and so on. These file systems have served us well for a long time, but they are really showing their age. They show a lot of legacy really from the original Unix file systems that they were patterned on many years ago. There's a lot of 15-year-old and older technology in these file systems, and they don't always scale very well to the size of the storage devices that we are working with today, or the sorts of technologies that we are seeing, such as solid-state devices, which bring challenges of their own. And then there are some issues about what guarantees we offer the user space from our file systems that I will come back to momentarily. Our first solution in this area is the ext4 file system. This is really just the next evolutionary step forward from ext3. It looks a lot the same, but it has a lot of advantages, including better performance. There's a whole lot of limits lifted, limits on the size of files, and limits on the size of the file systems you can create, and so on. So it will scale better to the very large arrays that we're seeing now and the large devices that are coming. But it remains quite compatible with ext3 in a lot of ways. You can actually mount an ext3 file system as ext4 and carry it forward that way. It is still stabilizing. There are still things that are being fixed. The patch rate is still relatively high for this file system. But it generally works pretty well. A lot of people are using it. Some of the more leading edge and community oriented distributors are starting to set up ext4 as the default file system for new distribution install. We're just seeing that beginning to happen. If you were running some large mission critical system, you will probably wait just a little bit longer before you use ext4. But for many uses, it is really ready now. But even the ext4 developers will admit that this file system is a sort of stopgap. It is something to keep us going for the next few years. But ext4 still shows a lot of the legacy from our older file systems and still lacks a lot of the sort of features that people want to see in a contemporary file system. So it's not really the next generation file system that we will be expecting to use, say, 10 years from now, or even 5 years from now. That, instead, is almost certain to be a file system called ButterFS, which is a brand new file system written from scratch, started by Chris Mason at Oracle, is now seeing development from an awful lot of developers from a number of different companies. There's a lot of nice things in ButterFS, including very good performance in a lot of situations. It offers full checksumming of data, both data and metadata. So ButterFS can detect and often correct corruption of data that has happened on the disk drive in a way that cannot be done with ext4. It has a very fast and complete snapshotting feature so that you can take a snapshot of the state of the file system anytime you want. You can use that, for example, to create stable backups or to simply preserve the state of the file system at a given time. The snapshotting mechanism is fast enough that ButterFS actually does not use journaling for its transaction safety at all. Instead, it simply uses snapshots. Whenever it's going to apply some changes to the file system, it snapshots the current stable state, applies its changes, and then moves forward to the new state once the state is complete. There's no journal there at all in that sense. Letter FS also includes a whole bunch of internal volume management, rate codes. You can actually do multi-volume stuff within the Butter FS file system and not have to use a separate rate layer to do it. This code was merged for the 2.6.29 kernel, but it is certainly not considered ready for production use by any stretch of the imagination. They still are not entirely sure they won't change the on-disk format. There are features that still need to be developed, a lot of bugs to be fixed. So this is there in the mainline kernel for people who want to test it, or for people who want to work on making ButterFS better. But it is not ready for production use, and probably won't be this year. Maybe sometime in 2010, maybe they will say that it has stabilized to where we can use it. But even that is probably ambitious. It's a brand new file system, and it takes a long time before file system developers are ready to say that you can really trust your data to it, because they have found that their users get very unhappy if bugs turn up and data gets lost. And file system developers really don't like to have to move to a different country and change their name when all that data is lost. So they are very careful that way. Other stuff in the file system area, we saw for 2.6.30 the addition of a file system called NILFS, actually NILFS2. This is a log structured file system, which means that it tends to be very good if you're writing a lot of data. It's also well organized for solid state devices. It includes some nice versioning and snapshotting features, and again, it is available now in the 2.6.30 kernel. Also, 2.6.30 was the addition of EXOFS. This is a file system which is intended to run on top of object storage devices. These devices, remember, are devices which can actually do a lot of the management of files themselves. So it is a very simple file system which really just does the mapping between file names and directories to the objects which are stored on the disk. I don't know how much usage this file system will get, but it is there and is available for this kind of device. In the network file system area, beyond NFS and such that we have had in the kernel for some time, there's a project called CRFS, which is being done again at Oracle. Still very early stage. I don't know when this could be set to be ready. Another file system called PomLFS was merged in staging tree 4.2.6.30. This was done by a Russian developer, very fast file system and caching and so on. He makes some very impressive claims for what this file system can do, but I don't know how many people are really making use of it at this time. And then Parallel NFS is an upcoming standard, sort of an extension to NFS, allowing the distribution of files across multiple servers for performance reasons. Linux support for this is in the works, and we'll see that coming in over the course of the next year as this feature becomes ready for wider use. Okay, I mentioned a couple times solid-state storage devices. Solid-state storage is getting bigger and cheaper. It's already displacing rotating storage in a number of situations, and everybody really expects their use to grow. They're very nice devices, but they bring their own challenges, including constraints on transfer size and the alignment of the transfers you make to the disk, especially if you want to have the best performance. There can be wear leveling issues that the operating system may or may not have to worry about. So there's a lot that has to be done to support these devices well. So we're seeing a lot of tweaks to existing file systems to make them perform better on these devices, and any support for a feature called trim, by which a file system can tell the low-level device that a particular range of blocks does not contain data which is needed anymore. This allows the solid-state device to do its garbage collection and wear leveling and so on, without the need to preserve data that the operating system knows it will no longer use. There's also a bunch of new file systems which are aimed at flash devices. These include UBIFS, which was merged for 2.6.27. UBIFS is interesting in that it requires direct access to the low-level flash device, which is actually something that we tend not to have with most solid-state storage devices. Most of these devices come with a translation layer built on top of them that make the device look like an ordinary disk drive. In fact, a lot of manufacturers are putting a whole lot of their effort and their product differentiation into the translation layers that they put on there. this makes for very easy to use devices, but it also takes away the ability for the operating system to really understand the device at the lowest level and work at it. So it's going to be interesting to see how that works out and whether there are all that many devices where we can use UBIFS beyond a few embedded systems here and there, or whether we'll be using ordinary file systems on top of flash translation layers. LogFS is another flash-oriented file system development, which I'm told is still alive, but it seems to be moving very slowly currently. I don't know when that might be ready. And again, NILFS, which I mentioned before, which was merged with the 2.6.3 kernel. There's one other interesting longer-term problem associated with these solid-state storage devices. These devices are very fast, and in the future, we can easily foresee a time when they will be capable of executing more than 100,000 operations per second. This is very different from rotating storage, which cannot handle anywhere near that number of I/O operations per second. So this will expose a lot of bottlenecks in the whole block and storage layer that we've never seen before. Because when you're doing tens or maybe hundreds of operations per second, you can handle a level of overhead in that layer that you really cannot stand if you're dealing with hundreds of thousands of operations per second. So what we are likely to see is a very determined optimization effort applied to the block layer, which makes it look an awful lot more like the networking stack. Networking has had this problem for a long time, where you're dealing with many thousands of packets per second, and every single microsecond or less of overhead that you apply to every packet really hurts you. And so you have to be very careful about how you handle it. This is going to have to happen to the block layer too, and that's going to bring some very big changes to that section of the code over the course of the next few years. And the last file system-oriented topic I wanted to talk to has to do with robustness guarantees. If you've been watching on LWN or elsewhere over the last few months, you've seen a big fuss. The POSIX standard, which the Linux kernel implements, says that data written to a file by an application is not actually guaranteed to exist on persistent storage until the application has explicitly flushed it there with an fsync system call. In truth, though, the ext3 file system in particular, for reasons totally unrelated to this, operates in such a way that applications did not have to do that. They could write data to files and just simply go on and not have to take the cost of actually synchronizing data to the disk and still be assured that in the case of a system crash or something like that, that this data would not be lost. The ext4 file system, as it happens, took away some of those guarantees in the name of making the file system perform better. So we started to have very early users of ext4 reporting that they were losing data in system crashes in situations where this wouldn't have happened before. And they were not happy about that. People don't like to lose data. The interesting thing is that the file system developers responded by saying that the applications which are losing data are not written according to the standard, that it's really a problem with the applications. It is not a problem with the file system. So in the point of view of the file system developers, the application developers were asking for too much. They were asking for everything in the world. And in the words of the file system developers, they might as well ask for a pony too. Okay, they want everything, they want a pony. So, but the thing is, as other people have put it out, have attested, perhaps it is not unreasonable to ask for this particular pony. A system which is more robust and which does not lose data is a system that is friendlier to our users than a system which could lose data. So there has been, as a result of this, a big debate over what level of assurance the Linux kernel really owes to its users. And how far should we go to protect users against applications which are perhaps not written to the standards and so on. This is a discussion that I expect to play out for some time yet. To me, I think the answer is fairly obvious. That a system which is more robust and which does not lose data is a better system for our users than a system that might lose data even if it runs a little bit faster. And in fact, we're seeing things moving in that direction. The worst of the problems with the ext4 file system have been fixed by those developers, even though they think that they're responding to a set of unreasonable requests in that regard. So I think things will resolve that way. I think it's the only right solution, but it's going to take a while for this discussion to play out in its entirety. And that's what I had to say about file systems. A related topic, sort of tied to the file system discussion, is various proposals for new APIs, new system calls that go in there. And I've just put up a few of them. FBarrier would be a way for applications to request that everything they have done so far be written to disk before any new operations they make. It's an attempt to solve the whole data robustness problem in a more efficient way. ACALL is a mechanism for calling system calls asynchronously, can support asynchronous I/O nicely, among other things. Reader Plus is a new way of querying directories that can be more efficient if you don't need all of the available information. RefLink is actually in fairly advanced state at this point. The RefLink system call can be thought of as a sort of cheap copy, where you can make a new link to a file that looks like a totally independent file, but the two files share the storage on disk, at least until one file or the other is changed. They behave like totally independent files, but they share storage, so they're stored more efficiently. That system call is going forward. There's an occasional request for a central event interface to the kernel. People talk about replacing the SOC interface with something that would work better in higher performance environments and so on. There's always a lot of interest in adding new interfaces to the kernel, making it do things in new and interesting ways. The counterpart to this is something that people like Linus will say every now and then, is that we can add this sort of interesting stuff to the kernel, but application developers tend not to use it. They tend to stick to the features that are standard, features that they can also find on Solaris, that they can find on Mac OS X, they can find on any other sort of Linux type system or Unix type system that is out there. So the addition of new features is something that always has to be looked at very carefully, because they often sit there and don't actually get used, even if they do very interesting things. Okay, moving forward. Virtualization has been a big buzzword for years. In the Linux kernel, the virtualization job is actually mostly done. We have very good support for virtualization through a number of mechanisms. The biggest exception is a piece of the Xen virtualization mechanism called DOM0. DOM0 is essentially part of the hypervisor. It is a special privileged guest which runs and provides services to other guests running on the system. It is certainly needed by any Xen implementation out there currently. It is being held up because there are some very strong objections to how DOM0 has been implemented. It's going to need some changes. So they wanted this code in by now, but it is not in, and I don't think it's going to go in anytime in the very near future, because it needs a lot of work yet. But the Xen developers are persistent, and I assume they'll get there at some point. Beyond that, it's mostly just adding performance, wider architecture support, and of course, all the features you need to actually manage whole bunch of virtualized ES, and that's mostly a user space problem. A bit less advanced is the related concept of containers. Containers can be thought of as something much like full virtualization, except that containers don't have their own virtual machine. They're actually just a walled off area, all running on the host system's kernel, but isolated from each other. The problem with containers that makes it actually much harder than virtualization in a number of ways is that you have to find every globally visible resource in the kernel and wrap a namespace layer around it so you can provide different views of it to different containers. So this includes, for example, the file system. Different containers will have different views of the Linux file system. It includes which processes are actually running on the system. Even the system time is a global resource which has to be virtualized for containers, so the different containers can have a different idea of what time it is. So this has been a long process to make all this stuff work in ways that don't interfere with the operation of the kernel when containers are not in use. So it's taken much longer than I think the developers had wished it would take, and it's still going on. Beyond that, there's need for resource controllers to be able to control the resource usage of each container on the system. And then features like checkpoint restart, which is the ability to take a container and save its state to disk, then restore it at some future time, perhaps on an entirely different host system altogether, and allow it to continue running from the point where it was checkpointed. This is a very difficult feature to implement correctly. on Linux. And it's not actually entirely clear that this problem can be solved in a fully general sense. But there are people who are putting a lot of work into it, and we will see where it goes in the future. But that's where we stand in games. Hardware support. I used to talk a lot about our problems with hardware support because we used to have a lot of them. Most of these problems are gone now. Linux has support for an unbelievable range of hardware with more coming in all the time. There aren't that many problem areas left. But there are a few, there always will be. These include graphics adapters. I've already mentioned these with the graphics execution manager and kernel mode setting code that has gone in. So we're getting close to having top quality support, initially for Intel hardware, expanding out to other hardware as well. That problem is being solved. Some network adapters are still problematic, although that's getting better. For the most part, we're in pretty good shape for hardware support. One of the things, I've already mentioned this before, the staging tree, a home for drivers which are not yet really up to kernel quality standards. This has brought support for a whole lot more hardware into the mainline kernel. And people are starting to work on those drivers and fix them up and get them really up to the level of quality that we need. A related problem to this is power management. This is an area of continuing interest, both to make our laptops work well and make our batteries last longer, but also to make our planet last longer in general. In general, this is just to make each piece of hardware work on its own sort of problem. You just have to find each device which doesn't suspend properly or which just isn't responding correctly to power management commands and fix it. So it can be compared to a game of whack-a-mole where something pops up, you bash on it, the problem goes away, and then you wait for the next one to pop up. And people are busily whacking moles and making things work better all the time. One sort of area of controversy with this still with power management is that there are two approaches that people like to take to power management. The approach that you see in most mainline kernel code is to try to run each component of the kernel at the lowest power level that is consistent with the kind of operation that you need. And there are various interfaces in the kernel for specifying what sort of response times you need, what kind of latencies you can handle at given times, and allows the kernel to try to make decisions on how it should operate each piece of hardware in there. Systems like Android in particular take a very different approach where they don't really worry about that. Instead, they simply try to just stop the whole system as much of the time as they can and have the entire computer be asleep as much as possible and do their power management that way. So there's some tension between these two approaches and making them both work and play well together. In the end, we're clearly going to have to support both because that's what's out there. But we'll see some work in the power management area still trying to do that to get some of the Android code into the kernel and so on so that we support power management in both modes. Cool. Moving on to real time. By real time, I mean the ability to support to offer truly deterministic response times to external events. That's really what people mean when they say real-time. Getting honest deterministic real-time support in a general-purpose kernel is, in a sense, a problem that has never been solved and one that a lot of real-time developers would say simply cannot be solved. But there are always Linux developers who will take a claim like that as a challenge and set out to prove that, in fact, they can solve this problem. So we have a set of developers working on what's called the real-time preemption tree, and one of them being Thomas Bleichser, who admitted that he thought it would take many years to get this in, and in fact it has taken many years to get all the code in. But what has happened, in fact, is that these people have developed a real-time solution, which has been in some sense stable, even though it's under heavy development still, for some years. In fact, it's being shipped by a number of developers out there. You see people in the embedded systems area shipping the real-time preemption code so that they can get the sort of response that they need out of the devices they're shipping. But you also see a great deal of interest in real-time in the high-end enterprise Linux area where people are deploying Linux for real-time trading systems, for example, stock and commodities exchanges, that sort of thing. When you're trying to do commodities trading, and you make or lose money depending on how quickly you can respond to events in the market, you want to know that the system will respond at a given time. So there's actually a lot of interest in real time in that area, which is sort of a surprising thing for some of us. So this code, like I said, has been shipped for years by a lot of these vendors, even though some of it's still out of tree. A lot of the user visible changes are in the mainline, so all the interfaces needed to support real-time have been in the mainline kernel for some time now. What's not is some of the low-level support. You'll notice that I've scratched off threaded interrupt handlers because those were merged from the 2630 kernel. This allows drivers to take their interrupt handlers and have them run not in interrupt mode, but as a separate process on the system. When they're running as a separate process, they can be preempted and pushed aside if something more important comes along. So once interrupt handlers are running this way, they are no longer a problem for the system if it has to respond to something urgent going on somewhere else. Sleeping mutexes are another feature that, again, aimed at allowing the system to respond quickly no matter what is going on. It's a change to the fundamental, the spin lock mechanism that's in the kernel, fundamental mutual exclusion primitives, to make the whole kernel preemptible at pretty much any time so that the kernel can, in fact, respond to events no matter what is going on. That code is not yet in the mainline. It may take a little while yet. It's still a little bit controversial there, and they want to make some changes to it. And a whole bunch of bits and pieces and latency fixes and so on. But slowly this code is going in, and maybe a year from now we can say that the real-time code has been merged and we have proper real-time support in the mainline kernel. But people who've seen me give this talk before know that I was saying that a year ago, so one has to take that with a grain of salt. Okay, security, just touch on very briefly. We saw the addition of the Tomoyo Linux security module for 2630 and the integrity management code. I already discussed those. Still waiting on the wings are AppArmor, which is another path name-based mandatory access control module. This has been shipped by Novell, shipped by Ubuntu and some others, but development there seems to have really slowed down. I'm not sure if this code is going to make it into the mainline or not at this point. We will see about that. FA Notify, instead, is a set of file system interfaces which allow a privileged process in user space to actually interpose itself between other processes in the files they access. So if a process tries to open a file, this particular daemon gets notified. It can maybe look at the file first and then tell the kernel whether the attempt to open that file should be allowed to succeed or not. This feature is meant to support virus scanning and other sorts of features in the mainline kernel. It is not an approach to security which has a lot of fans in the kernel development community, but there seems to be a lot of demand for it, so we'll support it. That stuff could go in as soon as 2631. I don't know if it's quite ready yet or not, but we should see that sometime fairly soon. There's also the issue of sandboxing. This is something that's come up again recently. The Google Chrome browser developers would like a way to run programs in a very restricted sort of environment. So there's some discussion on the right ways to support that. With a number of options of how we could do it with it. Okay, tracing, a lot of interest has been for a long time in providing the ability to look inside a kernel running in a production mode and to see what's going on and perhaps track down performance problems or other sorts of issues in the kernel. Solaris, of course, supports dtrace and has been a big marketing issue, big marketing point for Sun. So it would be nice if Linux had the same sort of feature. The presumptive answer to this problem for some time has been a system called SystemTap, which is, in fact, a very powerful dynamic tracing environment, can do an awful lot of things. But it does also run into some difficulties. It's complex and it's hard to use. Requires a lot of data that you have to drag around in your kernel. And there's been a real disconnect between the SystemTap developers and the kernel development community, to the point that kernel developers tend not to use it. So this has really slowed down its adoption and so on, and has inspired interest in other tracing solutions. So in recent times, we've seen the addition of ftrace, which went in back in October. This is a lightweight tracing facility, which is popular with kernel developers. So there have been a lot of features added to it. So you can trace function calls within the kernel. You can trace latency issues. You can trace a number of things. It's gaining the ability to trace things like static trace points, which are also being added to the kernel. It's gaining a lot of features that you would want to see in a serious tracing package, but in a very different approach. There's also a very long-standing project out there that's been around for many years called the Linux Trace Toolkit, which is a well-advanced static tracing toolkit, has a lot of very nice user space tools for analysis of trace data and so on. And that we may see another push to merge that sometime fairly soon. It's a nice feature, but neither F-Trace nor LTT can do dynamic tracing the way that SystemTap can do. And neither one can trace user space events in the way that SystemTap can almost do. So these are features that people want. So there still isn't really a full alternative to SystemTap. So we have to hope that that project stabilizes and gets to the point where it can see what it is in the near future. Then my final topic has to do with participation. The kernel development community is growing. We talked back at the beginning about just how big it is, with over 2,000 developers contributing over the course of any given year. But we still have issues with how this process works. This includes people who are shipping binary-only modules and not giving back to the community, holding on to code that they have developed internally. This hurts our community and also hurts the quality of that code. As I mentioned before, the code which is in the mainline kernel is generally better code. We really want it to be there. There are issues with language barriers. As we try to grow our community beyond its roots in North America and Europe, we get into areas where people have a harder time working in English, which is still the language of development for most of the kernel. So we're seeing a lot of effort to translate documents and to work with that. Cultural differences also come into play in various parts of the world and so on. So bringing more developers into our development process is an ongoing process. There's a lot of things being done, including things like this particular event, which I hope will inspire people to work more with the development community. I will be speaking more tomorrow about participation in the development process and how that's to be done. Greg will be talking about that. There's going to be a lot of talk on participation and development over the course of the next couple of days, and I'm looking forward to it. I'd also point out that in the kernel now, in the documentation directory, is a development process document that I wrote, which has a lot of information on how to work with the kernel development community. And with that, I will stop. If there are questions, I will be happy to answer them. There must be at least one question.
Hello. I have one particular question for Taiwan industry. That actually Taiwan many of Taiwanese software developers are working for embedded system, and actually in the slide you mentioned that most of the current heavy development progress are kernel development are actually sponsored by big companies like IBM, Red Hat. Actually, those are systems are actually a quite huge system, and right now actually that in the Taiwan industry, as far as I know that the current main kernel version in the development system actually still stay at about 2.6, about 10, about 17 or 18. The even though there are a lot of progress in the 20s, for example, splice or good scheduling of the based on the group, like based on the user by the complete fast scheduling, all those kind of improvements actually are from the big system viewpoint. But from the embedded system, actually, those good things are not intrinsic to our to the embedded system. In that sense, that some particular good thing for the 20s, actually, it would be very difficult for us to move into back to the 10th. For example, like splice can improve the main moving performance and some tracing capability and the K-probe. Those kind of good things actually are still very rare or still in the early stage at the 10th. So that from our point of view in the Taiwan, actually we always face this kind of difficulty. So that my question is that how does the main kernel development community take about the smaller device? That's the first question. The second question is that maybe not so technical, is that As far as I know, that Nina Tovat was quite against the KGDB to move into the main kernel branch, as it appears already in 2.6, 2.4. But from 2.6.26, it has already moved to the main kernel mainline. So that my point is that that is Linus Torvalds' attitude change to in his controlling of the kernel development, or the other forces actually has grow their influence to the direction of the mainline kernel development.
Okay, so there are two questions there. The first having to do with the participation with the embedded community in the kernel development community, and how the kernel community responds to small systems type changes. And the answer to that is one that many of us have been giving for a long time. The community is made up of its members, and the way to get the kernel to meet your needs is to participate in the community and to try to drive it that way. So there is a great deal of interest in the community as a whole in encouraging a higher level of participation from the embedded community to try to get these developers to help and to bring their work and to help drive the kernel in their direction too, because there's a lot of good work that is being done there, and it really works best if we all work together. But the kernel developers who are not embedded developers cannot on their own make the kernel the best kernel possible for embedded systems. We really need the embedded community to help us there. So, yes, we do have actually three people who have been designated as embedded kernel maintainers who are supposed to help with that. So it is getting better. We are starting to see embedded systems companies participating at a level that they were not before. But it still is not at the level that we would like to see. And I think it hurts the embedded systems vendors as much as anybody else. On your other question about the merging KGDB, Linus Torvalds has always been prone to expressing very strong opinions on things that he believes. But one of the things that I think really has made him a strong leader for the kernel project all these years is the fact that he will change his mind if presented with evidence to the effect that he is wrong about something. So there have been many issues that he has expressed a very strong opinion on, but then people have found a way to solve the problem that was acceptable or have proved there really was a difficulty there that he didn't understand. So he still has a pretty strong hand over what goes into the kernel, but he has always been willing to change his mind if reason has shown that he should. Any other questions?
So may I ask if there is any story about that? We saw a lot of amazing change in the kernel tree, and is there in the past if there is anybody jump out and say, I have a pattern on the some algorithm, but the algorithm has been merged into a kernel tree. And if there is a story about this, how it's solved?
I guess I don't quite understand the question.
Just about a pattern issue, if the kernel tree has ever...
About patent issues?
Yeah, pattern issues.
To the greatest extent possible, the kernel developers try not to be concerned with a patent issue. But if there is a clear patent issue, especially one with a litigious company behind it, then that issue can certainly block the merging of code into the kernel. We saw an example with this with a development which is called KSM, or Kernel Shared Memory. It's a virtualization support feature which tries to find identical pages of memory and share them between virtualized guests. It can allow for much more efficient use of memory. In fact, it turns out that VMware has a patent on the technique that was used by this code. So the code was changed for that reason and for other reasons as well, for technical reasons. So a new version of that was posted about a month or so ago, which no longer uses the technique that was described in that patent, because nobody wanted to take on that particular challenge. Software patents are a huge problem, and they do definitely restrict the things that we can do in certain areas. And I don't think that problem is going to go away anytime soon. We can't ignore it, even though we wish we could. Any other questions? I think we're maybe a little over time anyway, so...
So I understand you're involved with a certain high-quality web application named LWN.net, which requires a subscription to access its premium content as it comes out. I was wondering if there are any Taiwanese companies that have a group subscription to the website, and let's say a Taiwanese engineer that works for an embedded company is trying to make the case to management that they should get a group subscription. Could you provide any talking points to help him win the argument?
Okay, well, yes, I write for LWN. Much of the information I have presented here is something that's been known to LWN readers for some time and much more. As for Taiwanese companies subscribing to LWN, I would have to go and look. We have over 100 corporate subscribers at this point, and I don't have that list in my head at the moment, so I don't have an answer to that. But yes, a subscription is necessary to access our content when it comes out. It does all become freely available after a week or so. But if you want it when it is current, that is how we support the operation of the site. As for talking points, you know, I would suggest that people read LWN and subscribe to it, because we do our best to make it the best source of information about Linux development, Linux kernel development and beyond, that is out there. And the chances are that your competitors are already subscribing and getting their information from us, and so you wouldn't want to be left out of that, and it helps to support the work that you're doing.
Windows 的 Drive WDM model 里面有一个 IRP 的机制 In WDM driver, there is a Windows driver model, there is an IRP for layerless stack driver. And I think it is a well structured the mechanism for driver. And I want to know why the Linux don't have the motivation for such kind of design.
Is the question about the provision of a stable driver interface in general? Is that what you were asking? Or are you thinking about a specific?
I think the question is about a specific Windows driver mechanism called Interrupt Routine Package, IRP.
Yes.
So, my problem that I know anything about that.
Yeah, I don't know anything about any specific Windows interface. I can tell you, though, the kernel developers are very resistant to the creation of any specific sentence and stabilized interface to drivers, because any kind of such interface very strongly restricts their ability to evolve the kernel forward in the future and to fix problems and to make things work properly in future generations. So the internal interfaces in the kernel are very deliberately not stabilized at any given state. They will change from one kernel to the next. So they can always be the best interfaces that we can have them be at any given time. For drivers that are in the kernel tree, this is just not a problem at all. For people who are trying to maintain drivers outside of the kernel, that can be a difficulty at times. Does that answer your question?
所以我的建议是你可能会需要在可能这场节目结束以后再解释一下 IRP 大概这个机制是用来做什么的，那咱们才跟你回答说 Linux kernel 里面怎么解决一样的问题这样子。好
，OK， 那。
Okay. 因为时间的那个限制，所以Johnson 那个明天还有一个 session 哦，所以那中午的时候我们有些休息哦，那各位可以在那个。